Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Hey, everybody, welcome to the Michael Steele Podcast. I'm Michael Steele. It's so great to have you guys in the house. Yes, we are all still in the house, those of us who are responsible citizens. The rest of y'all need to check it. I don't know what y'all doing out there. As we're seeing the numbers begin to spike again. We told you this, what, 3-4 weeks ago? It's going to happen. Come on, pay attention. We got a lot to talk about here on the podcast today. So glad you can be with us. As I said, you know you can find me on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn, Spotify, all those good spots where you get your podcast on. And, of course, follow me on Twitter, at Michael Steele. But here we are, and what I think is going to be a fun conversation. I've watched this guy over the years, and I've had the pleasure of actually being on his podcast. So this is really kind of cool to have the opportunity to have him come and stop and sit down here for a little bit. None other than Clay Aiken. We know him as a singer, television personality, an actor, political candidate. An activist. I mean, this brother is doing it all, and he's doing it well. He's doing it well. You know him. He was a runner-up on the second season of American Idol back in 2003. Clay, I can't even believe it was that long ago, brother. 17 freaking years?
My joints know it. My joints definitely know it.
It's been a while. But the voice is still strong. He's still out there doing his thing, and certainly his debut album, Measure of a Man, went multi-platinum back in the day. He previously worked as a UNICEF ambassador. And beginning in 2006, he served a 2-year term to the Presidential Committee for People with Intellectual Disabilities. He is the host, as I said before, of Politicon's weekly podcast, How the Heck Are We Gonna Get Along? Clay, welcome to the podcast, baby.
I wish I could give you an answer to that. We haven't figured it out yet, though.
No, but I'm telling you, it's a fun listen for folks. I highly recommend you check it out because it's very interactive, very conversational, and Clay just has this sort of calming demeanor. I mean, you know,
I appreciate that. I wish I could get everyone to be calm. Right. Not always, though. Not
well,
always.
I was going to say, because you get some hotheads on the podcast. You it goes back and forth for you, and there are a lot of issues out there that I think brings that out of folks these days. That sort of edginess. So it takes some folks, someone who's got the ability to sort of say, okay, let's bring the temperature down a little bit to have the conversation. How did you make that transition? Because I think it's interesting for people to see, for someone like yourself who's played so much in the media space, personality, someone who people have watched on television and in some case literally grown up with and in sort of watching your career. How have you made that transition to, you know, the activist space where you're about an agenda, you're about a message, you're about a narrative that goes beyond, you know, popsicles and music? You know what I'm saying? That sort of light stuff, you know, that people could escape to. You're now bringing a real part of yourself to the narrative.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's probably what it really is more than anything, is being myself. I stumbled into Idol. I was a special ed teacher before Idol. I always followed politics through my ninth grade year. I made posters dreaming of my political campaigns when I was an adult. And when I was in eighth grade, we had to all write a story, an article, a paper, whatever you want to call it, in eighth grade social studies about someone we admired. Everybody else did their youth minister, their dance teacher, their pastor, whatever.
Right.
I called Terry Sanford, who was senator of North Carolina,
yes,
senator back then,
yes,
and asked him if I could come to his office and interview him. And he let me come. And I sat down and interviewed him and wrote my paper about Terry Sanford, who was then and still is my political idol. And so I've always been interested in politics. Idol, in a way, was sort of a detour.
It was a detour. Okay.
A little bit, you know, I auditioned mostly to get someone to shut up nagging me about it and accidentally stayed the entire time. So I don't regret that in any way whatsoever. But, you know, I kind of said when I even in my first audition that I love singing. I love being able to. I love that God let me do that. But I also like the idea of having people listen to what I had to say.
Right.
And if I was able to get to a point where I could sing and have a platform, I wanted to use it for something else. And I got fortunate enough that the platform was big enough that I was able to do that. So it is a big transition for a lot of people in the country who saw me and put me in that,
sure,
singing box. But for me, I don't know that it really is as big a transition because it's something I always was passionate about.
Well, I have to tell you, I'll be honest, you know, I'd straight up honest with you. When you ran for Congress,
you thought, what the hell?
I did. I'm not going to bullshit you. I absolutely did. I was like, okay, yeah, right. This, you know, seriously, come on, seriously.
Right.
You know, and it says a lot about how the country, on the whole, looks at these individuals who do other things, that we know them from other spaces, you know, entertainment, the news media, you know, business. And then when they cross over into this sort of foreign territory, and particularly those of us who are in the space already, we're a little bit territorial. We're kind of like, what the hell are you doing over here? I'm not trying to be an actor. Why are you trying to do politics? But what we miss is the fact that, as you just noted, for you, okay, that's my job. That was an opportunity. I did it. But my passion is somewhere else. And you're kind of following that passion. And but for Idol, as you noted from your youth, you would have been on that track anyway. So you just,
right,
took a slight detour. And it's how I, you know, I tell people that, you know, when I get a little bit judgmental like that, I said, I forget I too did the detour because I went off into a monastery and then wound my way back into politics as opposed to a direct shot. So we all kind of have our way of getting to where God needs us to be.
You know, and I also found it very funny because so many people hate politicians, right?
Right.
We can't stand politicians. But as soon as someone who's not a politician tries to run for something, we think, why the hell aren't you,
right,
doing what you're not supposed to be here? It's
right.
Just, I mean, it really is a double-edged sword. And we do like to put people in boxes. And I mean, how many medical doctors are in Congress now? There are a lot of people who've transitioned to another field. But I think the name recognition and being so identified with that one show, and really also being so identified with I was 24 when I was on Idol,
wow,
but I was still young. That was old for today's contestants,
yeah,
but back then,
yeah,
it was really young, and people watched me grow. I ain't going to pretend that I looked cool at all when I walked on that stage. I was a mess, but people sort of watched the kid next door grow up,
right,
and I still, to this day, I'm in my 40s, and people think I'm 24, which is wonderfully nice at times.
Yeah, I'm sure.
But at other times, it really stinks because a lot of people, especially in that campaign, saw me as this 24-year-old kid from Idol and had a hard time getting past that when I wanted to talk about healthcare or,
right,
veterans issues,
right,
or anything,
well,
that was related to the campaign.
To your credit, and again, as someone who does politics and certainly, you know, grooming, working with, you know, and sort of preparing candidates, you ran a very good campaign. It wasn't just respectable. It was a good campaign. And, you know, you talked about those things that were important to you personally, but also connected them to the community that you were looking to represent. And that's where the talent, to use that term, of having that public persona, being in the public's eye, being able to read them and feel them, really comes into play for those who do transition into politics, who've done something else. You know, those who kind of come up in the system, to be honest, are a hell of a lot more cynical than those like yourself and even myself. And I've been in a long time, but I didn't come directly in. I kind of went out and came in and went out and came in. You have a different perspective. You understand what people are kind of going through, which is why moments like we find ourselves in right now is almost tailor-made for voices like yours, and certainly the voices of especially the female candidates we saw running in 2018, the kind of candidates we see running now in 2020. This makes a unique opportunity to have the conversation around the things you were just talking about, and you layer in a lot of the tensions that are brought on by the current administration and the way they handle COVID-19, the economy, race relations, if you will. That also adds a little bit more sauce and flavor. You don't have to be overly partisan because of the way people are kind of looking at these things.
Do you think that's true, though? Do you not? I mean, part of me, I want to agree with everything you just said. I want to believe that you don't have to be overly partisan. But sometimes I fear, people ask me a lot now, are you going to run again? Will you run for something again? And my answer is always, I don't think I could win a primary today, Michael. I don't know if I'd be, because I don't have patience for bullshit. I don't have patience for, you know, saying the sky is falling every time the president plays golf. Now, there's my philosophy is there's plenty to be upset about. I don't need to create something new. I don't need to create some to be indignant about everything, because there's plenty that I can be upset about. But I worry now that the way to be successful, unfortunately, at least in my party, is to be pissed off about everything. And God forbid I say, you know what, I just don't have the energy or the bandwidth to be upset about that particular thing because there's too much other stuff. But the minute I do that, I find that people on my side who are further left than me just don't have any patience for me. Like I'm canceled myself simply for not being willing to throw fireballs every single minute.
You raise a very good point, and I think it's important to distinguish between the two actors that you're talking about, because they are two very different actors. The first is the folks inside the party, the activist, the political operative, the sort of jaundiced player who has this sort of partisan edge about them that sees everything through the lens of attack, you know, destroy, partisan pushback, etc. And there's a time and space for that in the political chess game. There is. I mean, sometimes in order to corner the king, you gotta go through some rooks and some knights and pawns. We get that. But then there's the other audience, which is everybody else. And my point is, I think everybody else has moved into something different. I correct myself. They are moving, or at least want to move, into something different.
We're all better at picking up that BS. I mean, I think we've grown up, not grown up, but we've certainly in the past 10 years, everything is YouTube now. It's all reality shows that aren't real, but we can tell when something is not scripted. Right. We can tell when something is not fake, and I think that we see the fakeness. We can pick up on it. We can identify the BS a little bit easier now.
Right.
I do wonder still, and maybe this is me having done the one campaign. I'm already a cynic too.
Right.
But this is me worrying that even though we can identify it, I don't know if enough people are yet ready, at least where I am, to vote. I always say, listen, if we want politics to be different, we've got to change the way and the types of people we vote for.
That's right.
But we haven't quite done it yet.
Well, and I'll tell you a little dirty secret. The way you get there is by elevating those candidates into that space. Because one of the things that I keep trying to navigate and conversate about inside the Republican Party, as we look at what Trump has done to the party, we're past the what he is doing to the party. He's done it. It is now wholly his creation. His Frankenstein creation is this new GOP. But the question then becomes, within that, how do you move into a different time and space. You cannot have the ball and chain of this party as it's currently configured carrying you into the future. It's going to require someone or someones that can break that chain. And that's going to require a different voice, a different kind of messaging, and a different way to operationalize around policy and issues and the conversation. That's what I think people are kind of waiting for.
Excite people over boredom, too. I mean,
right.
God bless Joe Biden. I understand that a lot of people on the far left of my party don't love him because they don't think he's exciting. Michael, that's exactly why I like him. I need some boredom right now. I'm excited about boring. I'm so ready for 4 years of boring. But it's very difficult to get people excited about something that's
well, the Democrats have you, as you know, Clay. They got to fall in love. They got to have be wooed, and the stars have got to shine 24/7, and they've got to have twinkle in their eyes. Mm-hmm. Republicans are much more pragmatic about it. It's like, okay, can your ass win? Because that's what we're getting behind.
I'm thankful that this time, for whatever reason, the stars did align for us to actually vote for someone who I believe can and will win. But I was worried there for a while that people were going to fall in love and not in line.
Well, so that leads me to a good question then. What do you think of Biden's current rise in the polls and the fact that in states like Michigan, battleground state for sure, state that Trump won in 16, was part of the 78,000 vote majority, electoral college majority that he got. Now he's down by 12 or 15 points in Michigan. He's hemorrhaging in Florida.
Every time you say more, I just get more excited.
Right.
Keep on talking.
He's hemorrhaging
about it.
In Florida. he is tied in Ohio.
Tied in North Carolina, where I am.
Tied in North Carolina,
which says a lot. I mean, listen, I'm a bad person to be able to act as if though I'm not biased. Joe Biden was the first person I ever gave any money to as a candidate, and that was in 2008, mm-hmm. back when he ran in the primary for president in 2008. So I've loved Joe Biden since long before he was tagged for vice president. I think it's for the same reason that I'm excited by him. I think that this year I don't believe that we could have run my dog and beat Trump, like a lot of progressives seem to think, oh, we could run an armchair and we'd still beat Trump. I don't believe that's the case.
No.
I believe that in 2016, there were four pockets of voters: Hillary voters who voted for Hillary voters who voted against Trump. I might have been one of those.
Yep.
Hillary. And then there were Trump voters who voted for Trump. And there were a lot of Trump voters who voted against Hillary.
Yep.
You've said that yourself.
Yep.
I don't think we have that fourth block of voters this year. I think we've got Biden voters who are voting for him. We've got a lot of Biden voters who are voting against Trump, and we have Trump voters who are voting for Trump. But I don't know if I could find anyone who is going to vote for Trump because they're terrified of Biden.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. I think I could probably muster maybe one person out of 1,000.
But it ain't the size of that group that voted against
that's
Hillary.
That's right. That's the point. It's not a significant enough number to actually make a difference in the election. And I think to your earlier point about boring, the way I put it is that I think a lot of folks are looking around saying, and this is why I chose Biden as the Democratic nominee the week he announced. I was on air at MSNBC and talking about Biden getting into the race. And I looked at the camera and said, dude's going to be the nominee of the party. And everybody's like, right, sure. It's like, you don't understand. What America's going to be looking for is who can get me off crazy.
Yes.
It's like we have been at that party. You've been here. So I'm going to tell you, my audience has heard me say this before, right? You remember the party that started on Friday and ended on Sunday night. And you're sitting there going, oh, shit, I got to go to work tomorrow.
Oh, yeah, we're worn out.
Right?
Yeah.
Right?
We're all hungover.
And everybody's at that point where it's Sunday night and they realize, damn, I got to get up and go to work tomorrow. That's who they're looking for, that person that will, that has that sort of I got to get up and go to work. They're looking to move off of the party. They're looking to move off of not party as in political, but party as in, hey, good times.
Well, there's been a, have we not for the last five, six cycles really moved towards not voting for a president, but yes. voting for the lesser of two evils yes. every single time?
Yes.
And in 2016, I think it was a tougher choice for people to choose the lesser of two evils. I don't think Hillary was evil, but a lot of people did. And they said, okay, I know Hillary's evil, and I'm not sure if Trump's evil, but I think he is, but I don't know. So right. I'm gonna give him a shot.
And they just
this
thought
time
he was,
we know.
They thought he was right, we do. And I think a lot of it was a lot of people thought he was crazy. And they're like, okay, I can deal with crazy for 4 years because what's the worst that can happen, right?
Well, I'll tell you what I thought. I knew him. I did his show.
Yeah.
And the guy who I knew in 2011 when I taped Apprentice is, I mean, he doesn't exist anymore. But I will admit, I did not vote for Trump because I did not, I did think he was crazy and I don't dislike Hillary Clinton.
Right.
But I, after he won, tried to reassure those around me, listen, at the root, all he wants is to be loved. So maybe, maybe he will spend so much energy trying to be loved that he will actually do a good job.
Right.
Well, I was wrong about that. I mean, I think he calculated, which what a lot of candidates calculate now, if you've got an R behind your name or a D behind your name, a big chunk of people are never going to like you.
Right.
No matter what. And I think he calculated, or maybe Steve Bannon told him, you've got that R behind your name, so it doesn't matter what you do. You're never going to get Democrats to all of a sudden vote, to all of a sudden like you. So you might as well make sure you keep your folks excited.
Right.
And that to me is probably the more, I mean, Trump is the most dangerous thing right now. But that, that general sense of no matter what somebody has behind their name, I've made my mind up. End of discussion. I think that's the thing that scares me the most in politics today, because I have to be willing to vote for a Republican who I think is honest and good and right. I disagree with. I would vote for you, Michael, not because I'll agree with you on everything.
Right.
I'm sure we won't, but because I know you're not motivated by selfish interests.
Right.
You want the, you know, and I got to say, I dare say this out loud because if I ever run again, it'll get used against me. But Richard Burr is my senator here. Tom right. Tillis, I can't stand. But Richard Burr.
Right.
Richard
right.
Burr, you know what? I don't agree with him on most things. But I do believe that he, for the most part, is a decent person. And so do I need to be thankful that there are I'm not going to get rid of Republicans, right? I can't do it.
Right.
It's not going to happen.
Right.
So I might as well reward those who I think are willing to listen to the other side on occasion.
Well, you make an interesting point, Clay, because the question of decency, which was a very important barometer for much of our modern day political politics, a lot of folks sort of looked at these individuals through that lens, you know. Yeah, he's a so-and-so on this and that. I don't agree with him. But, you know, he's a decent guy. I mean, he's going to serve the interests of the people well. We've moved off of that now.
Yeah.
A lot of these political actors are not in that space where you can say that because they are more self-interested. We've seen that in vote after vote from Sandy Hook, when 90% of the country said, help us move the needle on gun violence, and our elected leaders punted. They said no. And when you look at the response on healthcare, when we move the needle and then they try to undo after the people have expressed their will and say, hey, we do want this, they want to repeal and replace. And that's just not against Republicans, but you can see on both sides where these issues where the public is saying we want some movement, their self-interest, and again, we have examples during the Trump
years.
Listen,
we've got one right now,
right.
And I'll come after my party at the moment. The bill that was introduced by Tim Scott in the Senate to sort of rein in some over-policing, ban chokeholds, et cetera. You know, is it perfect? No. Is it better than what we have and have had? Yeah. And I am disappointed in a lot of people in my party for allowing the perfect to be the enemy of the good. It doesn't go as far as I might believe we need to get, but it's a lot better than nothing. And I'm sort of, you know, maybe I'm in the minority on the left, but I'm sort of, I'd rather make some progress than none. And I'm not sure that there's anything in Tim Scott's version of this bill that's necessarily going to hurt. So why are we stopping it? And you know, a lot of people would say self-interest. Let's drag this out until November and make it a campaign issue. I don't know if that's going to work.
Well, yeah. And it's a very interesting point, because I come from now from the Republican side, have a different perspective. I thought that he could have given a bone to at least one of the things that the Democrats were putting in the bill in the House. So instead of studying, policing issues, we already know what they are. Just make a definitive statement on chokeholds. I mean, why do we need to study?
Do you sink the whole bill in?
No, but that's my point. But that's my point. Knowing where your opposition is going to come, what steps do you take to mitigate that as much as possible? Because because to the extent that you say as a Democrat, if your side had just sort of, you know, said, okay, don't let the good be perfect be the enemy of the good, I would say the same on the other side. You saw what they were developing in the House. Why would you write a bill that you know is going to be DOA with the House members? Can you at least begin to put the steps towards a bridge, knowing that at a bare minimum, we don't think police should be doing chokeholds, so just ban them outright. That's an easy. You don't need to check with the police union on that.
That's a fair point, but it makes me think I need to change the name of our show to "Do We Even Want to Get Along?" Because I'm not sure we ever do.
Well, that's the question. Why is it put in that context? Because what we do as citizens, and this is where I beat up on we the people, because we have abdicated our responsibility, all right, all the time, not just in critical times. So people upset after Sandy Hook, people are upset after the killing of George Floyd, people are upset after a mass shooting in Florida, et cetera. But in between all of that, what do? We abdicate our civic responsibility to hold these SOBs accountable every single day and to threaten them appropriately with their jobs. And this goes back to the point we were just talking about how much do you value your job over your service to the people who put you in that job? In other words, it's more important to me to get reelected than it is to actually do something about gun violence, to do something about policing in the black community, to do something about redlining Hispanic neighborhoods, to do something about fill in the blank. And so where do we then step into it? We get outraged, Clay, but
do we not forget? I mean, do we not miss the point? I mean, I agree that all of those things you just mentioned, all of the real systemic changes that you and I were just talking about 2.5 weeks ago when you did our show, do you feel like some of that has gotten lost? Some of that political capital that was available to get some of these systemic changes done, do you feel like some of it has been lost in the canceling of, I mean, I guess I call it Band-Aids in some way. They're things that are important. I don't want Confederate statues on my state capitol grounds.
Right.
I don't think we need to be celebrating those things. But I do worry that focusing so much energy on that has taken away some energy from actual systemic changes. And I'm, to be honest with you, I'm a little pissed at white people right now.
Right.
Because white people are the ones who are talking about canceling a lot of these things. And every black person I talk to is staying on message. They're talking about, why have we not arrested the cops that shot Breonna Taylor?
Right.
They're talking about the policing changes that need to be done. And then white people, in a very different form of racism, but still racism, are acting as if though we know better about what should be done.
I'm so glad you brought that up, because I have to admit, I had some of my buddies laughing last weekend on Juneteenth. I was watching all this stuff going on around the country and watching these events around Juneteenth, and I texted some of my friends. I said, Damn, white people are more black on Juneteenth than black folks are. I mean, these guys,
It's an empty gesture, though.
I was like, what the hell? I mean, it's like, I'm looking at these rallies on Juneteenth, right? And I know what Juneteenth looked like last year, right?
Right. And this year,
this year, I'm like, okay, for every black person, like 7 white people at this rally. Okay, that's fine. And someone, a friend of mine, said, yeah, they're trying to figure out where the black folks are. I was like, yeah, we're at the barbecue. That's where we are.
Well, listen.
We do on Juneteenth. Come on.
My black friends have, one of my very best friends and I have a text chain where she just sends me copies of every time something has, the Dixie Chicks changed their name today. Splash Mountain has been changed. The name of Splash Mountain has been changed. And she just lists, she's making a list for me of a whole bunch of things white people are doing in the wake of George Floyd that no black person ever asked for.
Right.
No one asked for Splash Mountain to have its name changed. People didn't know. I didn't know until this morning that it was apparently offensive. But listen, I'm fine with it. I'm fine with these changes as long as we're actually focusing on the important things. And I asked you 2 weeks ago if you were afraid, and I need you to reassure me now because you did then. But I asked you 2 weeks ago if you believed that this time would be different, if you believed that we would focus on the important things, and you made me feel really good about it. But I got to tell you, Michael, I'm worried that in places like North Carolina, where our Republican General Assembly actually set aside $4 million for, it's an empty gesture, but was making some progress on criminal justice reform in this state. And they set aside $4 million to erect monuments to the Greensboro sit-ins, to Shaw University, to the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, which was formed in Raleigh. They were making some progress. When people tore down the Confederate monuments on the Capitol grounds, they canceled all of that stuff. And I know that was a bitch move for them to do, but it does make me worry. Shit. Are we going to forget why we came here?
Well, I think what makes this difference is on a number of fronts. But I think core to that is the fact that black folks now basically have said, now that we have your attention, I just believe that the narrative, the conversation itself is going to be much more intense. And there is this stronger commitment for the follow-up. You're not just going to walk away from this as easily as we have other things. We're not going to, because now that we've gotten white folks to acknowledge Black Lives Matter without the rejoinder, well, all lives matter, So now that we've gotten your attention, now you figured out what Juneteenth is, okay, we got to teach you what it isn't, but now we got to, know what it is, right? The conversation is going to change. It's going to change by virtue of the fact that when I look at this current generation, and your son is going to be part of something a lot bigger than you and a hell of a lot bigger than me. I'm at the end of the baby boomers. You are what? You're the...
I'm Gen X still, right at the tail, yeah.
Right. So, your son, who is 20 years younger than my youngest, is in a very prime position, because his appreciation of the racial narrative is going to be formed differently, because part of the challenge has been in the past, communities, particularly white communities, have been able to isolate themselves rather neatly into their own little package. And so they could germinate. I watched a viral video the other day of this white woman telling, I'm going to teach my sons to hate you people, right? This was her response to Black Lives Matter. And I started laughing at that. And people were like, why are you laughing at that? That's serious. I said, you know what? Because her son will not be able to do that. He will not be able to learn that behavior, because the world is going to be, and by the world, I don't mean globally. I'm speaking just here in the U.S., in his neighborhood. What he's going to be exposed to is going to far outreach what his mom is going to teach him. And so he'll be able to decide. Now, if he decides, okay, mama's right, I hate black people, okay, that's one thing. But my bet is the challenge is going to be harder to spew that kind of hate and to inculcate it into future generations
certainly.
The way we have.
Oh, certainly. And when it is so obvious and so blatant, I'm happy every time I see a news story about someone being fired because they've done something so blatantly racist. But I do wonder and say, I do want to say, because I haven't heard anybody say it directly. I had Ellie Mistel on this week's show that came out today.
Right.
And he reiterated, to him, black folks are not the ones calling for Lady Antebellum to change their name or
That's
for Splash
right.
Mountain. And so what I haven't heard, and I asked him, I said, well, someone needs to say it. I don't know who it will be, but I want to say personally, white people who are acting like they know how to fix this are being just as racist as anything, because the bottom line is we should be listening and we should be taking our lead from the people who have been oppressed and who have had these things done, who've seen racism and lived it. And if we're acting like we know what's better, and if white people are saying we need to get rid of Uncle Ben's and Aunt Jemima off of these boxes, then we're acting like we know better. And to me, that's also a form of racism. I want the lead to be taken by people who are experiencing it. And it really pisses me off when white people act like we know better.
Well, and you're pretty good at that. you've had 400 years of practice at it.
But I don't want to be a part of the problem is my point.
Well, no,
and, you know,
and I appreciate
I think
that.
We have to, and I think that we have to stop taking the lead here, and it happens in the media, it happens in communities. It's people who are acting as if though, well, we know how to fix this. And I get worried that the few people who I hear talking about the real systemic changes that will actually save lives and affect people's lives, redlining, police brutality, chokeholds, police unions, etc., those messages are not being heard because I think people are too busy canceling 30 Rock episodes, which I'm not saying is a bad thing. It's probably necessary to talk about those things, but I want to make sure we don't lose the real message. And I want to make sure that we're doing things that are actually going to change people's lives and make things better for and safer.
We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we got more with Mr. Clay Aiken right after this.
Everyone loses golf balls, even the pros. When you need golf balls, go to LostGolfBalls.com, the world's largest inventory of used golf balls. All the top brands in stock, 50% off retail. LostGolfBalls.com.
Okay, everybody, welcome back. We're talking with the incredible Clay Aiken, singer, television personality, all that good stuff, as you know, but insightful and committed activist in a number of social spaces. One of the things that I'm curious about from your perspective, Clay, and you've touched on it a little bit, but I want to drill down a little bit more on it, because back in 2016, you had defended the president from accusations of racism during that 16 election cycle. Has your views kind of shifted in light of what we?
Yes.
Okay. I'm just asking.
I got in a little bit of trouble because I had tried to temper my feelings. I knew him in 2011.
Right.
I knew him in 2012, and I did not see that part of him when I was around him. But I wanted to, I don't want to throw that term around lightly. And so I was very careful. I actually changed my tune after Charlottesville.
Yes.
And
that was a turner for a lot of people. Right.
And got in some trouble got hit from both sides because I tweeted, and nobody pays attention to my tweets, but I did tweet something to the effect of, hey, remember all those times I said Donald Trump wasn't racist? Well, I was a fucking idiot.
Right.
I'm sorry.
Right.
He is.
Right.
Of course, people on the left were mad that I didn't say it sooner, and people on the right were mad that I said it in the first place. It was definitely a turning point for me. And I think for me, the issue was the difference between saying something that could be construed as being racist, like there were good people on both sides,
right.
And maybe thinking afterwards, oh shit, I can see how that would be racist. Maybe I shouldn't say that. And I was hoping that he wouldn't say it again, but he said it. He went back into his office. Someone told him that wasn't a good thing to say. You shouldn't say it. And then his dumbass came out 2 days later and said it again.
Yes.
And it's one thing to make a mistake and not repeat the mistake. But when you make a mistake and you double down on it, then you meant to make it. And
I consider myself a little bit of a Trump whisperer, having worked with him myself, kind of had conversations with him around his thinking on a few things. And here's the one of many takeaways I have about Trump. But the one is, Trump will always, and I emphasize always, when he's take the script out of the way, right? Don't give him a piece of paper, right? Mm-hmm. He will always tell you what he thinks. He will always tell you what he thinks. He doesn't know. There's no filter. There's no way he's going to shade it and be kind of coy about it, you know, like a politician or someone in the media. He's a visceral guy.
Well, so, I know him as someone I knew him as someone who was terrified to offend anyone. When he fired somebody on The Apprentice, they cut out a good half hour of him blowing smoke up their ass before he finally had the balls to say, "You're fired," because he just did not want to offend whoever he was firing. And so when I heard him say that, I thought that was just a really sloppy and inappropriate way people on the other side.
That's different, though. I mean, the whole apprentice thing with the firing, that's a different thing. I mean,
oh, no, you're right.
That's not the same as making a statement of belief, because that's what that was. When he first said it, there are good people on both sides. That's a statement of belief. The correction was the White House saying, "Dude, you can't say that shit publicly. Are you kidding me?"
And then he did it again.
and why did he do it again? Think about what the situation was.
Because I believed it. He believed it.
No, he believed it the first time. That's the point. The correction. He believed it the first time. He told you viscerally what he thought and he felt about the moment. Then the White House put a script in front of him and said, "Read this." Okay. Then on Monday or Tuesday, after he read the script saying, "Oh, I don't know what I was talking about. I'm old," right? He comes out, he has the press conference, and he has the conversation that comes up again. And what does he do? He reverts back to what he really believed. He will always tell you what he really believes. And that's something I tell people. Don't get upset about that.
I was going to ask that question. Yeah.
Wouldn't
you rather people admit?
I want to know. Ignorant? Thank right. you. Let me know where you stand. So when I blow your ass up, I got good grounds to stand on.
Listen,
to do it.
I am going to get in trouble with a lot of people in my party too. I'm glad that the Supreme Court has ruled in cases that allow people to, you know, that people can't discriminate. But I also said, listen, if you want to be homophobic and not serve gay people, that's your choice, but you should be required to put a sign up outside that says, "I don't like gay people." So at least that way I know who to avoid. And everybody else knows who to avoid. If you want to be foolish, just own it. And in a way, and I'm not defending him in any way, but in a way, I think I'd rather at least know that Donald Trump is racist and have him openly admit it so that we can know to run the hell away from him and get rid of him, than someone who is covertly doing evil things behind closed doors and then lying to our faces.
What do you think? Because you're a personality, you're a public figure, I kind of chuckled when you said, "Oh yeah, no one pays attention to my Twitter." They do. By the reaction you got, obviously, they do.
Yeah. Oh, no, I got them.
what do you think about this idea that public figures like yourself, do you have a responsibility to speak out on these political issues? Now, you're a little bit different because you're a candidate. You are in the political space. But more broadly speaking, how do you weigh that? How is that weighed in the minds of a lot of your people, the friends that you have in Hollywood and entertainment?
You know, I don't know. I handle it differently, I think, than a lot of people in my business. I have not been as... So, first of all, I'm not very social media heavy. I don't tweet and post very often. when something like this comes up, I tend to lay back because I don't want to end up being a part of the scrum of attention that, right. that's being, you know, the cause celeb. I do worry sometimes that people in Hollywood jump on the bandwagon and post things that maybe they don't even know what they're talking about. I actually posted something today on Instagram, on an Instagram story. It was probably one of, not the first, but one of the first things that I posted surrounding the whole George Floyd and police brutality right. and over-policing thing in quite a while. It was about police unions, and I think we talked about that last time I spoke mm-hmm. to you too, about the need to rein in some of the overpower that police unions have. But I don't tweet too often because I feel like walk softly and carry a big stick may not be the exact phrase to use, but I don't, I want to make sure that when I do say something, it is of value and not just for the sake of it,
right.
Of saying something. Do people have a responsibility? I think that's, I don't know if I think that's fair. I would like to believe that if you have a platform, you will use it for good. But if, as long as you're not using it for bad, if you choose to stay out of it, I think we all have, I think we all should have the right to stay quiet if we want to stay quiet. I don't know that I'm going to be on the bandwagon of saying that if you don't say something, you're part of the problem. It's tough to say that. It's tough to have an opinion on that, honestly, because I see both sides. But I do find that, you know, I choose not to speak up because I feel if you talk too much, people stop listening to you.
Right.
And I'd rather make sure that I'm saying something seldom and powerful than constantly speaking. I don't know about the responsibility part. And I guess part of the reason that I say that is because there are people who have very different opinions than I do, and I kind of want them to shut up. So I don't want to pretend that they have a responsibility to share their ignorance.
Yeah, no, it makes a lot of sense. Well, and part of it, you know, when you look at the celebrity story narrative, there's the Jussie Smollett situation, all right, on one end of the spectrum where he abused his celebrity.
Oh, God.
In a most horrific way, and rightly suffers the damnation and condemnation of that. But then you look at the Bubba Wallace story on the other end, sort of the reluctant celebrity who's kind of thrust into the spotlight because of circumstances and conditions. And you sort of have this, tactically how it can be kind of perilous to sort of navigate this space because you're a celebrity. My adage is always check that shit once, twice, seven times before you go public and make a statement. I can't tell you the number of times before I tweet some things out. I actually spend time researching and sort of looking at the different angles of a story. I don't just take the first story I read.
You know, the other thing that's important too is, at least in my opinion, after I've done that, because I try to be careful about the way I word right. something, but once I hit send, I put the phone away.
You have to.
I don't want to see the responses. If it's something that is important You're enough
like
for me
that
to
way.
Say,
yeah. Yeah.
If you said something that is important enough for me to say, and I have chosen to share an opinion, and I don't always, unless I'm in a forum like this, but I don't do it on Twitter very often. If it's something that I feel is important and I feel like I can own it, then I don't need to second guess myself because two or three people on Twitter have decided that I didn't do it the right way. So I put the phone away once I've twatted.
Especially twatted. Do you think though your twats
right?
do you think that your tweets and the tweets of other celebrities, not just even tweets, but you know, the public, you know, public pronouncements that they made, we've seen recently from LeBron James and others who've spoken, you know, on the Black Lives Matter situation, and certainly now, folks sort of, oh, gee, I guess Colin Kaepernick was right. Makeup, you know, it's almost like, okay, we got to figure out ways to amend, atone for that sin. Do you think the public buys that? Do you think that those messages and words, tweets make a measurable difference?
On Twitter, I don't know if they
opinion.
Do. On Twitter, I don't know if they do, but I have found that a lot of news outlets have gotten in my opinion, a little lazy. They don't want to talk to people. Maybe it's coronavirus and they're not going out. I don't know.
Right.
But they just take their quotes from Twitter. They do their stories based on what's on Twitter. And so when a news source picks up LeBron James tweets and runs them in a news article, I think, and gives them more platform than they had just with the tweet. Yeah, of course, I think that can have an impact. But I don't know about your news feed, but I did an experiment with my mother a few weeks ago where I opened up my Google News app on my phone and I opened up her Google News app on her phone, and none of the stories were the same. You know, we have been, these algorithms cater to us.
Tailored to you. Yeah.
Yeah. I used to get the Salons and the Huff Posts and the Slates and the more progressive stuff. My mom is always Washington Examiner, Fox News, Breitbart, Federalist, all that stuff. News is not even the same for us. I have gotten to where now I refuse. I say, don't show me any stories anymore from any news source that's not New York Times, Washington Post, my local paper, et cetera, like just reputable, real journalism, because I'm not interested in the clickbait stuff. I think there are some news outlets that act as if though Twitter is the pulse of the country, and I'm not convinced that it really is. I think that Twitter is the pulse of the celebrity culture and the pulse of a small segment, very small percentage of America, maybe 5% of Americans who spend all their time on their computer.
Yeah, no, there are a lot of them out there, and they pay attention to, in some cases, to a lot of the wrong stuff. And a good example of that for me is this, the whole COVID-19 resurgence resurgence is a continuation of, I mean, people hasn't sunk into them that we have not completed phase one of this thing yet. And the problem is phase one can get extended into when, you know, the fall comes, and then it becomes a whole nother nightmare. And a lot of it has to do with what we see coming out of the leadership of the country, where we've now relegated wearing a mask to a political statement.
Right? What is that about?
It's bullshit is what it is. It's the most dumbass thing in the world. I cannot believe people are that damn stupid that they're going to weigh their life and their health. And okay, fine. You don't give a crap about your own. But what about your mama and your daddy, your grandma and your granddaddy, the people that you come into contact with who then come in contact with the elderly? You know, and this idea that, oh, yeah, well, I'm not going to take it to my parents, but I'm hanging out with someone who goes back home to their mama who is friends with your mama and she gets it that way. You don't.
Well, we also aren't really enforcing it as well as we should.
I mean,
politicians who are running, I feel lucky that in my state, our governor just extended our phase, was supposed to switch to phase three on Friday. Tomorrow, but we're not doing it for three more weeks. And now he has mandated masks, but they've pretty much said they're not going to be enforcing it. So what's the point? I mean, we need to be better about enforcing. If you're going to make a rule, if you're going to make a law, then enforce it. Don't just do it in this band-aid crap. This statement crap doesn't fly with me at all. That's that bullshit that I can sniff out, you know?
Yeah.
If you're going to make a rule about wearing a mask, then enforce it. And if you see someone not wearing them, write them a ticket.
So in your view, we should be concerned about not just an extension of the first wave, but the coming of a second wave of COVID-19.
Well, I'm not going to pretend that I know, and I'm going to listen to the experts, and I'm talking about the real experts who went to medical school or got their MPH, and that's the only folks I want to listen to when it comes to whether or not this disease is something that we need to worry about resurging. But I agree with you completely. What the hell does it hurt you to put a mask on? Right. I mean, to me, that's just, it's not about the, we know that wearing a mask, the experts at least have said, probably doesn't prevent us from getting it, but it does reduce our ability to give it to other people. So when I see somebody not wearing a mask, that says, that's not a strong independent person to me. That's a selfish person who is saying by not wearing the mask, I don't give a shit about you and I'm going to be happier, you know. So I wear the mask I feel like the mask is 2020's version of a smile. You know, I'm wearing my mask, and my mask on is my way of telling you that I care about your health. So I'm going to put it on.
Well, what's important about that is two things. One, it's a good public service announcement to make, and so people know. And number two, just flashed across my screen here, U.S. coronavirus cases rise 1.7%, the biggest gain since May 30th.
And then another story this morning said that of every one case that we have reported, experts are believing that there are 10 that have not been documented.
That's exactly right. In fact, a lot of that has been around for a while, because what they're beginning to realize is not just on the number of cases reported, but the number of deaths that have occurred from COVID-19 may be significantly higher than, because particularly early on, they didn't know and they didn't test the dead for COVID-19.
Oh, right.
This thing is much more serious than a lot of people pretend it is.
And at the end of the day, even if it isn't, even, and this is hypothetical, even if we find out a year from now that it wasn't necessary to do these things, I don't know, I'm not a doctor, don't quote me on those things, but if we did, what the hell does it hurt you to wear a mask? It doesn't. And I think that's what's fascinating to me. You know, people were pissed off in this state about not being able to go out of their house, not being able to reopen their businesses. Well, I really hope, Michael, that if people don't follow the mask guidelines that Governor Cooper has laid out in North Carolina, I hope to God he shuts them down again. You know, if we have to go back to phase one, take your pick. Either you can stay inside and we can shut everything down, or you can wear a mask.
That's kind of what it boils down to.
You can't be pissed off about both.
Yeah.
You were mad that you couldn't open your business. I understand that. But you've been told now you can open your business as long as you wear a mask and take the 6-foot precaution. If that is too much for you, then get your ass back inside. That's what I say. This is why I'll never be governor. Because I would say it just like that.
I love it. Oh, I found a kindred spirit here, friends. I have found a kindred spirit. His name is Clay Aiken. Who would have thunk it?
Who would have thought?
Who would have thunk it? Clay Aiken, you're the best, man. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Perfect way to end this podcast. This is the perfect way, because it reminds me so much of my mama when I was a boy. she want me to come in the house, and I'm like, no, I want to stay outside. I want to be outside. She looked at me and said, get your ass in the house. Like, yes, ma'am. That was a get your ass in the house moment from Clay Aiken, America. I love it. He is, as I said, a singer, television personality, actor, political candidate, all the good stuff. But I think we can call him friend. He's a good guy. I'm glad you took a time to come by and hang out on the podcast, man.
Honored anytime.
This has been great fun. And don't forget to check him out as the host of Politicon's weekly podcast, How the Heck Are We Gonna Get Along? That is none other than Clay Aiken. You can follow him on Twitter @ClayAiken. And certainly it has been a real pleasure having him on board. That'll do it for this week, folks. Please stay inside if you don't need to go out. And if you do, put the damn mask on. Mm-hmm. As my brother just said, put the mask on. Get your ass back inside. All right, folks. Catch me on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, TuneIn. You know where to find me when you do that download thing, which I love when you do the download thing. And certainly on Twitter @MichaelSteele. Peace out, y'all. Catch you next time.
Your local Health Mart pharmacy is putting the personal care back in healthcare. We know you by name, not by refill number. Visit healthmart.com for the location near you. Health Mart, caring for you and about you.
Everyone loses golf balls, even the pros. When you need golf balls, go to lostgolfballs.com, the world's largest inventory of used golf balls. All the top brands, in stock, 50% off retail. lostgolfballs.com.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
You have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today.
Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.